Before we get started with today's episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight, we want to let you know that we have exclusive bonus content on Patreon at patreon.com/ampedup. You can find the video versions of all our interviews, so make sure you check out our bonus content today at patreon.com/ampedup. Thanks for your support and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Amped Up. This is your host, Ryan Knight, and our guest today is Justin Paglino. Justin is running for Congress under the Green Party in Connecticut's 3rd District. Justin, welcome to Amped Up.
Thank you very much, Ryan. It's great to be here.
Since this is your first time on the show, can you just share a little bit about your backstory and why you're running for Congress?
Well, yeah, I am originally went to medical school and had a career in medicine and science. I worked for 15 years in research, getting a PhD and then doing a postdoc. I studied oncolytic viruses, which are viruses that infect tumor cells, and published several papers. And I enjoyed the work. It was challenging. But I kind of came to a point where I kind of wanted a second act, as some people say, in their life, and I wanted to do something different. I've always been kind of really absorbed by politics and follow politics very closely my whole life, and also music. And so those are kind of two things that I didn't have a lot of time for when I was full-time working in the lab. Also, I'm married with two kids, and that takes up a lot of time as well. So I made a transition in, 2019, and became a full-time musician, piano teacher, slash activist. And really, I wasn't planning to run for office. I never planned to run for office. It was just something that kind of, everything kind of aligned, where I was looking for something to do as an activist that I thought would have the greatest impact. And I decided this was it. And I think my experiences proved me correct. So if there's one thing I want to encourage everybody out there who's an activist to consider doing, it's running for office. It can have a big impact. You get your thoughts get published in newspapers. I appeared on a publicized on a live televised debate with Rosa DeLauro and her Republican opponent. It was pretty amazing.
What? So you ran initially in 2020, and so you're running again in 2022. What did you learn from your first campaign that you think will help you in this next campaign in 2022?
Well, I think one thing that I accomplished during the first campaign that'll help me in my second campaign is to get on the ballot. As you know, for third parties, it's extremely hard. It's extremely challenging just to get your name to appear in black and white on the ballot and not be a write-in candidate. So I had to collect about 2,000 plus signatures, and I had some help. But that was, I myself had to get 800 or 900 of them. And that was hours upon hours in parking lots, approaching all comers, asking for their signature. And people give you their signature pretty readily. You say, you're not voting for me. This is just to get me on the ballot. But still, you don't realize how many 2,000 signatures is until you have to actually go out and get them. So that puts me at an advantage for next time because I don't have to do that again. In Connecticut, the law is if you win 1% of the vote, then you get to be on the ballot next time. And so that part's out of the way. And that's very, very helpful. I can focus more. It's incredible how much time that took. So now I can focus a lot more on campaigning. And one thing I want to do more of is put out more press releases. I have a new campaign manager. We're getting started early this time. It was kind of a last minute decision to even do this. So to be starting this early, I think is really going to help.
One thing that the corporate media talks about a lot is GOP voter suppression, which is definitely a problem in this country. But what's also a problem is how the Democrats suppress voter choice. And we've seen that in a variety of ways, first off, they sue to kick third parties off of ballots, like they did to the Green Party in 2020, in the presidential election. But they also make it harder for third parties to secure public funding, as they're doing right now with a bill they call the For the People Act, which I call the For the Duopoly Act, because it actually makes it harder for third parties to be viable and to secure public funding. And you touched on that a little bit ago, how the hoops they make you jump through, that they make third parties jump through. My question for you, Justin, is shouldn't a party that calls itself democratic support everyone having the right to vote for their party and candidate of choice? Is the Democratic Party anti-democratic?
Yes. I mean, they certainly put in a lot of effort to keep third parties like the Green Party off the ballot. And, you know, the advantage for them doing that is obvious, you know, that if they only have one opponent or one opponent who appears to be viable, that's a low bar for them, right? All they have to do is convince the voter that, you know, I'm better than your one other choice. You know, what are you going to do? Throw your vote away? Ha, ha, ha. And, you know, this brings me also to the issue of ranked choice voting, because really what I became aware of was that a lot of this work is done by for the Democrats and the Republicans to keep them in power, to keep the duopoly system going.
That's right.
A lot of that work is done for them by the first past the post voting system that we use. An incredible amount of the work is done for them. The fact that they even have to try, I think, is even more indication that there's enthusiasm for third parties. Because really, and I'm sure you know this, but maybe some listeners don't, but you know, in a first past the post system, the spoiler effect has this natural tendency to create a stigma against third parties because we're seen as spoilers. And there was a academician who's a scholar who studied this and named Duverger, and he called it Duverger's law, that in a first past the post voting system, the way we vote, where you just indicate one vote on the ballot, you will eventually, over time, you will narrow down the number of viable parties to two, because it just becomes unsustainable. It's just the dynamics of it become unsustainable to have three popular parties. It's like game theory. It's dynamics. It's math. And a lot of the reason we have a duopoly is because of that. And it's also psychology and sociology, and just the fact that these third parties are going to get stigmatized for being spoilers, whether they're on the left or the right or what have you. I had people ask me, you know, plead with me, please drop out. You know, and these are good meaning people who want good things. But they're terrified of third parties messing things up, screwing things up, right? So when I learned about ranked choice voting, it changed my whole worldview about American politics. And the problem with only having two viable choices, as you said, you know, is that, you know, it lowers the bar. All the person has to do is be better than their one opponent. And there's just a million examples of that. I mean, look at Joe Biden. You know, all he had to do to become president was be, you know, less distasteful than Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump is talking about lowering the bar. Right. Yeah.
But that's, like you said, that's the lowest bar in history. If all you have to do is be a little bit better than Trump. And in many ways, you know, many people on the real left will argue that, well, maybe Joe Biden's language is better than Trump's, and his kind of outward appearance and this kind of superficial veneer that he presents to the country, it sounds better than Trump's. There's also a sinister element to the Democratic Party, and that, you know, they talk every campaign, they talk progressive, they talk like a left party, but then they get in power and they govern like the right wing capitalist and imperialist party that they are. And so I think for many on the left, they're finally waking up to that and seeing that, yeah, you're right, it is the lowest bar in history, but also for the Democrats to just be, you know, to say every election, you know, vote for us because Republicans are bad. That's also not, you know, that's not a platform, you know. just Republicans bad, you know, that doesn't put food on anyone's table. That doesn't give anyone health care. That doesn't stop the climate crisis. You know, we've got major systemic issues in our society because of our decrepit capitalist system and because of the enormous wealth gap that has been created from our decrepit capitalist system. And all the Democrats want to do is sit and say, vote for us because Republicans are bad. Which again is not a message or a platform or a policy that's going to benefit anyone's life. So you're right. We're kind of stuck in this corrupt two-party system where both parties, while the Democrats might use nicer language, they both work for the ruling class. They both work for their corporate donors. They both work for Wall Street, you know, in the military-industrial complex. And so in many ways, I think the Democrats are more sinister and they kind of take advantage. They use fear. They use the fear of the Republicans to kind of get power, but then they just govern like Republicans. And so many of us are left here. When you said that, you know, you had people come to you saying that they're terrified that a third party could, you know, could be a spoiler. What actually is terrifying to me is what will continue to happen if we let these two corrupt right-wing capitalist parties continue to use our government to enrich themselves and enrich their corporate donors, you know, while everyday people are falling further and further behind and our planet is in decay because of the climate crisis. That is what's more terrifying to me, is if we don't find the courage to support candidates like yourself and to support third parties like the Green Party and to support, you know, other socialist parties as well.
Yeah, well, you know, I was a Democrat most of my life. I'm 48 now. When I was 18, I voted for Bill Clinton. And I think, you know, when you grow up and you read the news, you just kind of absorb the political culture that this is a two-party country. And that kind of makes voting easy in a sense. You don't have to think about it too much. You know, you kind of look at your two viable options or what you can see. You know, this is bad, right? You look at the two options and you say which one you like better, and you pick that one and you go with it. And I think for people to make the mental leap into thinking that something better is possible is difficult. It's kind of like you have to broaden your horizons. And for me, you know, that was difficult for a long time. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, it is so effective, this fear of the other, you know, and it's governing by fear. It's like extortion. It's like, hey, vote for me or else, you know, if I'm the Democrat, I may not be everything you want, but look how horrible things are going to get for you if you go and vote your conscience, if you go and vote your values, if you go and vote for Medicare for all, if you go and vote for the things you really care about, you're going to screw everything up. You're going to get a disaster.
So and look, we've seen the consequences now of the Democrats. You know, I remember since my first election, I remember the campaign slogan was "Vote for us or democracy will die." And celebrities were literally wearing "Vote or Die" t-shirts. But we've seen the consequences now of a system where people are voting out of fear, you know, instead of voting, like you said, out of their values and out of their hopes. And I think, if anything, the Democratic Party has robbed so many passionate people of their hopes and of their values by telling them, like, no, you just have to settle. You just have to hold your nose and vote for us. That's as good as it's ever going to get. And we're all over here. And when I finally woke up, I'm like, well, how are we ever going to get better? How is America, how is this world ever going to get better if we always have to vote from a place of fear? And we always have to compromise our values, and we all, for a corrupt corporate party, you know, how are things ever going to get better this way? And the truth is, they're not. You know, this kind of politics is only a politics that supports the oligarchy and supports the billionaire class. And you know, and so, you know, yesterday it just came out that the Biden administration is defending a Trump-era oil and gas project in Alaska that's designed to produce more than 100,000 barrels of oil a day for the next 30 years, despite Biden's pledge to pivot the country away from fossil fuels. This multi-billion dollar plan from ConocoPhillips to drill in the National Petroleum Reserve was approved by the Trump administration just last year. Environmental groups sued, arguing that the federal government failed to take into account the impact that drilling would have on wildlife and that burning the oil would have on global warming. What does it say, Justin, that What does it say about the about Joe Biden and the Democratic Party that here we are in the middle of the climate crisis, and instead of pushing for, you know, an eco-socialist Green New Deal, they're backing a Trump-era oil and gas project? And secondly, what does the Green Party need to do better to present itself as the only major left party in the United States that unequivocally supports an eco-socialist Green New Deal?
Yeah, well, here's another example of the bar being quite low. I mean, under Trump, you know, there was not even the admission that global warming was a problem. So, you know, this is the problem of two-party dynamics. You know, if all you have to do is be better than that, well, hey, oh yeah, I acknowledge global warming is a problem and I think we should do something about it, is all you have to say to get you some votes. And in fact, you know, they paused, you know, leasing on federal land for fossil fuel development. But there were so many leases approved under Trump, there's a backlog of years, it doesn't even matter. And he's already approved hundreds of drilling, issued hundreds of permits for drilling on federal lands. So, you know, of course, there's just enormous amounts of money driving the use of fossil fuels. I mean, fossil fuels are tremendously, they're tremendously amazing. I mean, it's an amazing amount of power that you get from burning fossil fuel, and it's tremendously useful. But people will pay for it. And there's billions of profit to be made. And how are we going to, you know, stop that? Because a lot of that profit then goes into influencing the political system because, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats take money from these companies. And, you know, even if there are some progressive Democrats on the fringes who really want to do something serious about this issue or Medicare for All, it's very hard for them to filter up to the leadership of that party, because that party's corrupt at the top. You know, to rise in the Democratic Party, to ascend, you really have to show that you can bring in money, that you're a fundraiser. And there are very few members of the party who are principled enough to say, I'm not going to take corporate donations. It just brings me back again to the fact that, you know, it's a low bar when there's only two options. And that's why I'm very excited about ranked choice voting. I mean, we're talking about an end to lesser evil voting. You talked about how with this system, we can't vote for what we want. I heard Howie Hawkins, who was the, you know, Green Party nominee for president, candidate for president, say, if you don't vote for something, you'll never get it. And that, I mean, it sounds simple, but I was in a time when that really, in a place where I was ready to hear that, and it really resonated with me. Here I am, I go to the polls, and I look at the two candidates, and I love the, you know, I'd love to, often there isn't even a Green Party candidate on the ballot. I mean, that's one of the reasons I did this, because there was nobody. I was just going to support whoever it was, to be honest. I was just going to find out who the candidate was and see if I could volunteer for them. There wasn't one. So when you go under ranked choice voting, you can actually go and vote for what you want. You know, if you want Medicare for All, you can go to your ballot and indicate that on the ballot. It's not just signing a petition. It's not just, I think it's more powerful than just voting in a primary for a more progressive Democrat than you want, because, you know, a lot of the action happens in November. That's where the decision gets made of who's going to be on the ballot. And not everybody's in the Democratic Party who wants Medicare for All. You know, there's a lot of people turned away from politics entirely, a third of eligible voters, you know, who don't vote because, I mean, it's crazy trying to fit everyone into two boxes, right? I mean, it's like, let's everybody, you're red or blue, and that's all you get. You know, pick your color. And people's politics are not that simple by far. It's ludicrous to think that we could fit everyone's political ideologies into two boxes, right? We see the Democrats splitting and we see the Republicans splitting along different lines. And, you know, 2/3 of voters say they'd love to see a third party. But, you know, what I like to emphasize is that with ranked choice voting, you can have it. You can go, you rank your choices on the ballot, 1, 2, 3. You indicate number one, who you like the best. It makes all the difference in the world. And I'm not sure, I don't think it'll immediately change things, but it takes away that third party stigma. And that gives third parties the room they need to grow. Because, you know, third parties facing that stigma make it hard. We've got the Democrats doing other things to keep us down, of course. But really, I think it's Duverger's law that has doomed third parties in this country. And luckily, we can get rid of it. And they already have in Alaska, and they already have in Maine. And the New York primary is going to use ranked choice voting. Municipalities all across the country are using ranked choice voting. And I'm very excited about it. I think it's coming at a time when there's enthusiasm for third parties, there's an understanding for a need for third parties, and the mechanism to make that possible, which is changing the way we vote. And I think a lot of people kind of neglect to talk about that third one. So I like to give it extra emphasis. No,
absolutely. I think that for me, the big things that keep the corrupt duopoly intact is yes, our voting system, and ranked choice voting would certainly help in that respect. And then also how elections are funded. Ever since Citizens United was overturned and these two, you know, corporate parties could take even more dark money and take even more money from billionaires and corporations. I mean, that just, you know, corrupted our politics even more. And then the kind of the final component that keeps them in power also is our corporate media system. You know, whether it's MSNBC or CNN or Fox News, you know, those cable networks, they're either pro DNC or pro RNC. And they're all pro big business and they're really anti working class and anti any progressive policy that would benefit the majority of the American people. And so I think that also plays a big factor on our elections. And I think we saw in the 2020 election cycle that, you know, Joe Biden got, I think it was something like $100 million in free advertising for the 3 days after the South Carolina primary heading into Super Tuesday. That really was a turning point. And so, you know, it just shows that, you know, these corporations, they don't just have a stranglehold on our government and on both political parties, but they also have a stranglehold on our media, which is why independent media is so important and the conversation me and you are having right now. Something like 90% of all media in this country is owned by just six corporations. And so you really see that, you know, the same fear that both parties use to stay in power. Also, you know, these talking heads on these cable media networks are, you know, they're part of the ruling class and they benefit from the status quo. They have a vested interest in it. You know, the giant corporations advertise on CNN and MSNBC and Fox News. And so, you know, they're never talking about policies like Medicare for All or a Green New Deal in a favorable light. It's always, oh, it's going to cost so much, you know, or, oh, you know, this or that. It's always fear around those policies. But when it comes to, you know, sending troops to war, when it comes to bailing out Wall Street and big banks, there's never fear. When that's the kind of politics that has led us to this nation now that is so unbalanced in favor of capital and in favor of the ruling class and rigged against the working class and the majority of the people in this country.
Yeah, and when you think about all the money that goes to politicians, think about where that money goes, where they spend it. It goes to those corporations for political advertising.
That's right.
They make so much money off of political advertising. They certainly are not going to be in favor of something that I think we should have, which would be using the public airwaves to share political, to share people's political point of view as a public service. Like, I think we should have, you know, we should allow candidates on the airways. It's a public good, and the airways belong to the public. And, you know, imagine, getting that idea onto a corporate news station, getting them to talk, even consider that idea, because that's shooting themselves in the foot because they they profit off of this.
Yeah, and it's the same way they lock out all the other candidates from the presidential debates. You know, they want it to just be the red oligarchy candidate and the blue oligarchy candidate. They don't want to let the Green Party or, you know, the socialist parties or the Libertarian Party debate in the general election, because that would give people more choices and maybe it would start to help people wake up to just how corrupt our politics is. There was another report that I pulled that we have to discuss because it's just absolutely ludicrous. Yesterday, it was reported that the Democratic-controlled Senate is pushing a $10 billion bailout for Jeff Bezos' space firm. Just think about that for a second. We have a government that refuses to provide health care to all of its people, but instead is willing to provide a $10 billion bailout to the space firm of the richest man in the world. And this shouldn't surprise anyone anymore, because this is exactly what happens when corporations and billionaires buy off both parties to rig the laws in their favor. What is surprising to me is that anyone could still support either of these corrupt parties who continue to put the endless greed of the ruling class over the basic needs of the people. Justin, why do you think so many people still support the corrupt two-party system that's rigged against them? And what do you see as the real keys to breaking the duopoly and establishing a multi-party democracy in the United States? And I know you kind of touched on ranked choice voting, which is a big component of it.
Right. And well, yeah, I mean, well, first let me address Medicare for All briefly, because, yeah, giving handouts to billionaires and millionaires is what we do when we refuse to adopt Medicare for All, because Medicare for All is less expensive, you know, and this is one of my top campaign issues, and it's the top difference between myself and Rosa DeLauro, who does not support Medicare for All. She's not one of the co-sponsors, you know, and when we preserve the profit motive and keep these private insurance companies afloat by not transitioning to single payer, you know, we're really doing it just to protect their business. I mean, that's all it is. And it's at the expense of people's health, because we still have millions of uninsured and so many underinsured, and people cannot afford to get the healthcare they need. And, you know, we, in terms of life expectancy, all kinds of measures, we track so low on the scale compared to other countries that have single payer healthcare. And, but I like to emphasize that Medicare for All is cheaper. You know, a lot of times it's framed as saying, well, we can afford to do this. If we can afford to do this, then we can afford Medicare for All. But really, we already have the more expensive system. So the question is, how can we afford to keep this expensive system that's just helping enrich people who are profiting off the system and leaving people out? You know, so when we go to single payer, you have efficiencies of scale, you take out the profit motive, you have lower overhead, you can negotiate drug prices, and everyone's in the same network, and you get universal coverage, and you save hundreds of billions of dollars. It's an amazing amount of money. It's, you know, the CBO just last fall or November, I think, put out a report estimating $400 or $500 billion. That's where a lot of the estimates come in of the different studies that look at this. So I got a little distracted when you brought up a Medicare for All there. But, you know, again, back to the question of breaking the duopoly, RCV, you know, I put all my emphasis on that in answering that question. Ranked choice voting. There are organizations in almost, I think, in all 50 states that are now pushing for ranked choice voting. I participate in one here in Connecticut called Voter Choice Connecticut. And, you know, we're trying to move the issue forward. We're trying to get the Connecticut legislature to pass a study bill. And that would just simply be a bill that forms a commission to look at the issue and consider it. You know, I'm really convinced that that is central. And until we get that, we're kind of going to be spinning our wheels. With trying to break out of duopoly. It's Duverger's law. It's math. It's game theory. You know, I think it's overlooked as in a lot of people who want third parties. I think this is overlooked as being a solution, but increasingly it's being appreciated, and I'm really happy to see that.
It was just revealed that the White House budget does not include key Biden campaign promises like the public option, prescription drug reform, and student debt relief. Biden and the Democrats have also walked back their promise on the $15 minimum wage and completely dropped even fighting for that policy. And let's remember, the public option is the moderate compromise. We need nothing less than Medicare for all. So what does it tell you about the Democratic Party that during a moment of historic inequality, when they control the entire government, that the House, the Senate, and the White House, that they're walking back their moderate promises instead of using their power to actually improve the lives of everyday people? And secondly, what kinds of policies do you support that would help restructure the economy for the working class?
Yeah, they're doing this because they can get away with it. You know, they because the bar is low, because all they have to do and for a political strategy is convince people that they're trying a little harder than the Republicans to do something for them, for the working class.
And I would just say that to push back, because I used to be, I mean, I was a Democrat for 18 years, but now I would just say that the Democrats lie better than the Republicans because they cover up their corruption better. The Democratic Party is bought and paid for by the exact same corporations and billionaires that the Republicans bought and paid for by. Yet the Democrats play to our heartstrings and give us all these lovely platitudes while they're campaigning and then turn around, get power, and after we work to help elect them, at least in past election cycles, I couldn't even vote for them in 2020. Not even the fear of Trump could get me to hold my nose and settle one more time for any evil. So I voted proudly for the Green Party and Howie Hawkins. But, you know, people help elect them, they get in power, and then they stab us in the back. And so how, you know, how are we ever going to break the duopoly if we're allowing these Democrats to present themselves as a left party when in reality they're a right-wing party? On any metric, the Democrats are a right-wing party. And yet I still feel like, well, I used to make excuses, and now I'm like, I can't even call them the lesser evil anymore. I think the whole system is evil. And I think the Democrats, again, they stop any movement to the left because they try to pretend like they're left when they're not. And I think that's more damaging than what the Republicans do, because the Republicans, yeah, they're corrupt. I'd never vote for them or support them. But they're not lying to us and telling us they're a left-wing party and that they care and that healthcare is a human right, while they're literally fighting against Medicare for all, like Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and the entire DNC are doing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this movie before. I remember when Obama campaigned on the public option, and that was the major point of disagreement in the primary debates between him and Hillary, was Obama wanted the public option, got to have the public option. And Hillary was like, no, I don't think so. I don't think it's a good idea. And that was like, as far as that was in terms of policy, that was like a major, the only really glaring major difference I could see between them. And then Obama gets elected and he never uttered the words public option again. It just disappeared. And that was part of the reason I supported him, you know? And so, you know, you get fooled enough times and you start to really see what's going on.
Yep.
And, you know, I read Listen Liberal by Thomas Frank.
It's a great book.
Fantastic book that it was part of this confluence of things that happened to me all at the same time that kind of opened my eyes to see that, you know, the Democrats really are corrupt. And it's not that they're trying to really give make these progressive policies happen. They're just trying to give the appearance that they're trying.
Yep.
And they look for convenient excuses, and they're not hard to find. Oh, like, oh, I'm sorry, you know, Joe Manchin doesn't want to get rid of the filibuster. I guess can't do it. But then sometimes they don't even try. They just campaign on it. And Joe Biden, now he's not even talking about, you know, the public option. And like you said, the public option is really not the solution. It's maybe a small step in the right direction. But what we really need, if we want to save hundreds of billions of dollars, is Medicare for all.
What's your reaction to the fact that progressives in Congress right now continue to heap undue praise onto Joe Biden, saying things like he's, quote unquote, exceeding expectations, despite the fact that, as I just mentioned, he's backpedaling on his moderate campaign promises? And
yeah.
And if you were elected to Congress, how would you use your seat to actually fight for the progressive policies that you're campaigning on? And how would your approach differ to that of the squad who continues to take a passive approach against the corrupt establishment?
Well, this is why, part of the reason I decided not to run as a Democrat is, first of all, I knew that the establishment of the Democratic Party would oppose me and try to fight me and make it hard for me to win against Rosa DeLauro. But also because I don't want to be a part of a corrupt party. I want to be offer a clear option of a party that doesn't take, you know, corporate bribes, that doesn't take PAC money. We're completely uncorrupted and unbought. The issue there, I think it's really about facing a lot of pressure to be a team player. When you're a member of the party, you go in there and you're depending on the higher ups. You want their support, but it comes at a cost. If you want the support, you have to be a team player. You have to be a Democrat. You get the talking points that you have to support, and you have to support our candidate. This is our guy. It's a team sport. You're all on the same team, so to speak. And if you break with that orthodoxy, there will be consequences. And so, I think that's why so time and time again, we see progressive Democrats getting into Congress who end up disappointing in a lot of ways and say things like, yeah, oh, Joe Biden's doing great, because, you know, they're just helping the team. They're just trying to make their team look good. That's like party propaganda. Yeah, we've got the best president. They're just jumping on board with that. If they start criticizing Joe Biden, I can only imagine what's going to happen. You know, they're going to lose the support of the party that they want the support of for their next election, and it's going to hurt.
Yeah, I mean, the problem that though is that both of these teams, the blue team and the red team, they're not competing for the people or competing to help the people. They're competing to help the ruling class and to help these giant corporations continue to make record profits. And so, you know, when you realize just how corrupt even the blue team is, you realize that, you know, progressives like AOC and Bernie and the squad, they should be fighting back against the corrupt establishment. That's essentially why the squad was elected, not to apologize for it and certainly not to join the establishment. I mean, you know, the whole idea, I think, is to fight for the people and to fight for policies that would benefit everyday people. And when Joe Biden's not doing that, to heap undue praise on him and just to act like everything's okay while millions of people don't have healthcare, while, you know, the recovery we're seeing from the pandemic, you know, it's been a K-shaped recovery. It's been an uneven recovery where, again, the upper middle class is doing better than they've ever done. The billionaire class is richer than they've ever been. The corporations are still making record profits. Yet the bottom 50%, poor and working class people, are getting poorer and poorer. And they're sitting here like, wait, when is someone going to actually fight for me? When is anyone going to fight for our interests? And so I think that, you know, because of the lack of fight from these progressives, I like to look at things from a positive perspective. I think it's just crystal clear to me that you can see that the progressives are not living up to their campaign promises. I mean, the squad, they took money from poor and working class people to go in there and fight for policies like Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. They did not take money from poor and working class people to get elected to, you know, be Joe Biden's mouthpiece and to apologize for his corruption. And so what I think this presents is it presents an opportunity to candidates like yourself, to the Green Party, to other third parties, to the socialist movement in this country, to the socialist parties, to start to build a real movement that's divorced from this corrupt duopoly, that's only going to fight for policies that benefit everyday people and benefit our planet, and really start to educate the people in this country just how corrupt both of these corporate parties in Washington are. And again, that, you know, we don't really have a left party, at least in office right now. And so I think, you know, what are your feelings on that? That the more the Democratic Party governs for its corporate donors and is just acting like a Republican Party 2.0, do you think that gives an opportunity for the Green Party, for independent parties to emerge that will unequivocally stand on the side of justice and dignity for all people?
Yeah, I think when you look at the enthusiasm there was for Bernie Sanders, an amazing amount of support coming out for, you know, student debt relief and universal single-payer Medicare for all, and raising the minimum wage, and all kinds of things that people are desperate for. And you really you really see the support for those policy issues, I think, in the Bernie Sanders movement. But then, you know, where those all that passion goes to die is the Democratic Party.
That's right.
It's really sad. I mean, you know, Bernie gets crushed and he gets, you know, pushed to the side. And, you know, and he doesn't call for a major third party. I mean, he's independent and I give him credit for that. Maybe that's kind of leading by example. I think that's noteworthy. But, you know, the Medicare for All has a lot of co-sponsors, 113 by last count in the House, but only one person has the power to decide whether it gets a floor vote or not, and that's Nancy Pelosi. And so, you know, if the party is, you know, bought at the top, there's you're fighting enormous forces if you're trying to get progressive change within a party like that. And so I think there is incredible frustration with the leadership of the Democratic Party. I think the Bernie Sanders movement does show that people are hungry for it. I just think people are still in that two-party mindset that you know, we were talking about earlier. And I think that's really the root of the problem, that people are scared. People are scared of leaving the Democratic Party because it's like their only hope. It's like we either get this or we get something worse, because they don't see a possibility of there being more than two parties. And it's really sad because people don't get to vote their values. They don't get to go in the voting booth and vote for what they want. And if they could do that, I think we'd start to see a government more representative of what people want and what people need. And the two-party system is never going to deliver that. Because of this, because they've got you trapped. And the two-party system, again, the end of duopoly for me is spelled RCV. That's the end of the Duverger's Law. That's the end of the spoiler effect. That's the end of people being cramped into two boxes. And it's the beginning of people being able to go to the ballot box and vote their values and feel good about it, you know? I'm sure you had the same feeling when you transitioned right from Democrat to Green, just this feeling of, you know, I get to like express my true values when I vote.
Absolutely. I mean, my whole life I voted from a place of fear. I voted from a place of, oh my gosh, but you know, I have to vote for the Democrats or the Republicans will win. But when you finally wake up and see just how corrupt the Democratic Party is, you see that, like you just shared, that there is no hope in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or the corrupt duopoly. That it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, the Democrats can tell all these wonderful stories from the campaign trail. They can use all these nice platitudes, but platitudes and false promises aren't going to, again, put food on anyone's table. They're not going to restructure the American economy that is rigged for the ruling class. You know, they're not going to save our planet from the climate crisis. They're not going to give anyone health care. And so we are just so far beyond these empty platitudes that the Democrats use to kind of sedate the public, you know, and present themselves as if they are a left party, when in reality, they just govern just like the Republicans do for their corporate donors. And so when you see that, you know, when I finally woke up to that 2 years ago, I thought, I'm not going to waste another single second of my life supporting a party that lies to me. And I'm not going to vote from a place of fear anymore. I don't think America will ever get better from a place of fear. I think we have to vote from a place of hope. Amidst every, you know, look, it's an uphill slog. It's a tough battle. You know, the duopoly has all the money. The Democrats and Republicans have all the money. They've got the giant corporations. They've got Wall Street. They've got the military-industrial complex. They've got every powerful billionaire and corporation on their side. But what we have is the people. And like you said, there is a growing movement in this country for a politics that is about justice and dignity for all people, for a politics that's about Medicare for All and about a Green New Deal and about, you know, defunding the police, and about living in a country and in a world where true equality is a reality, and where the working class actually are paid a living wage, and they're not just getting their labor exploited to enrich a handful of oligarchs that control the American economy. And so I think While the duopoly has corporate power on their side, we have people power on our side. And the other thing I would like to kind of ask you is, what do you think about the fact that, look, Bernie Sanders and AOC and the entire squad, they know how corrupt Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden are. They know that the 99% of the Democratic Party is bought and paid for by giant corporations and the billionaire class. What does it say, though, that they know how corrupt it is, yet they still keep participating in the corrupt system with this corrupt party instead of like actually breaking away from it? Because I think that if there's anyone who could actually lead a movement in this country away from the duopoly and towards, you know, a real independent party that's going to benefit the people, it would be a Bernie Sanders or an AOC. So what does it say about them that they know how corrupt the Democrats are, yet they still keep, you know, funneling more leftists into this corrupt party that's actively fighting against the socialist policies that we want to see enacted?
Yeah, it's very sad to see. And I think, you know, I don't know whether to give them the benefit of the doubt or not. I mean, they, you know, it seems like you can argue they're trying, like, for example, you know, the like DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, these people are very well intentioned. And, you know, I was a member of DFA, Democracy for America, which was the offshoot of the Howard Dean campaign, because he was the peace candidate during the time of the Iraq War, and I really got involved with his campaign. You know, so I think there's a lot of well-meaning people who see reform of the Democratic Party as the only way forward, right? They say, because they're in that two-party mindset. They say, well, we've got to, and I don't know that this is the Congress people you're talking about, but a lot of voters certainly, and a lot of people who really have all the best intentions, they really think that's the smart way forward. They'll consider what I'm trying to do kind of, you know, fruitless, or it's not going to go anywhere. You know, they really say, well, look, that's just never going to happen. We've got our only hope is to reform the Democratic Party and make it stronger and make it better. And I think that's unfortunate because we need people power to make a third party really happen. And I like the Green Party. I think it expresses my values, people, planet, and peace. You know, there's a movement for a People's Party that I haven't really looked into very carefully. You know, there's a socialist party. You know, the thing about ranked choice voting is we don't need to funnel all leftists into one party for it to work. It's one of the nice things about ranked choice voting is, you know, people can kind of, you can have three candidates that are on the left and from different parties, and you can rank them all near each other and, you know, and see who comes out on top. But you don't have to worry about splitting. You don't have to worry about splitting support among multiple, you know, progressive parties. So, you know, if there's one thing I could really convince people to do is trying to make that jump. And I really appreciate your voice on this issue, because I think that's what we need to see, is people coming to that conclusion that you did and that I did, is that it's not going to work. It's this idea of reforming the Democratic Party. It's not going to work because it's still staying within this lesser evil model, this two-party system, where it's just, it's numbers. When you have only two options and you're voting out of fear of the greater evil, you're going to compromise your own values when you vote. And as long as we're doing that, as long as we're going in and compromising our values when we vote, we're going to have a government with compromised values. And that's what we see. You know, we're getting, in some ways, we're getting what we vote for.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we have ranked choice voting and people can feel free to go and express themselves, you know, Medicare for All is wildly popular among voters, among Congress, not as much, right? Because people don't vote for it. You know, here in my district, people love Rosa DeLauro, and she does very well, but she doesn't support Medicare for All. But people are going to give her a pass on that because they don't even know about it. All they know is that she's better than the Republican. And I think, you know, there are some differences. I, my my feeling is the Democrats, but all they have to do is give you crumbs. All they have to do is, you know, they talk, maybe all they have to do is talk a good game, or, you know, maybe they give you some crumbs. You know, maybe they'll give you more crumbs than the Republicans will. You know, I don't necessarily say there's absolutely no difference between the parties. I mean, it depends on the specific example. When it comes to war, when it comes to spending on the Pentagon, there's absolutely no difference. Nope. They both love war. They both love, you know, there's a lot of defense contractors here in Connecticut. And Rosa, Representative DeLauros, always votes for the Pentagon budget, which is now over $700 billion. And, you know, no one, you know, is going to call her out to task for it. You know, even though people, if you poll them and ask them about the Pentagon budget, do you think it's too high? They'll say yes. But when they go to vote, they vote for the Democrat because they're better than the Republican. But they're not getting to express that opinion on the ballot. Until we get a ballot where we can express those values, we're not going to see them reflected in our government. So that's why, you know, I decided I had to do this. This is why I decided I had to do it a second time, is because I want people to be able to go into the ballot, the voting booth, and vote their values. I want, there has to be a candidate on the ballot who allows them to do that. And, you know, I encourage anybody who thinks they can run for office to go run for office and provide that same service to voters in your area, so that we can start getting a more accurate reflection of public sentiment on some of these issues. Because
you're absolutely right. The majority of the people support progressive policies. The majority of the American people, 70%, support Medicare for all. The majority of the American people support the Green New Deal and support, you know, real climate legislation. The majority of the people support, you know, reforming the police. And so you can go line item by line item on every major issue, and the majority of the American people are progressive. It's unfortunately the fact that our political system is dominated by two parties who are anti-progressive and pro-corporation and pro-ruling class and pro this kind of decrepit capitalist system, which just wants to funnel more and more money up to the top. And so as long as we have a government that's dominated by these two parties, we're just going to be having these same conversations, and we're going to have a Democratic Party. You know, when people talk about reforming the Democratic Party, I used to think that. Today, I live in reality, and I see that AOC, Bernie Sanders, all these progressives that talk a good game, they're not moving Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and the DNC left. The DNC actually keeps moving further to the right. You know, Joe Biden, right now we're in a healthcare crisis. We've got 92 million Americans who are either underinsured or uninsured. And Joe Biden, not only is he against Medicare for all, he said he'd veto it. He's against the public option and not even going to support the public option now, which is the moderate position. So this idea that AOC and Bernie are moving the Democrats to the left, I would say actually no, AOC and Bernie are moving their supporters to the right and deeper entrenched into this corrupt Democratic Party. So this, for me, it's a fantasy that you cannot move a party that is owned by Wall Street left. You know, that's like saying you're going to move Jeff Bezos left, or you're going to move, you know, the military industrial complex left, or you're going to move these giant corporations to the left. It's never going to happen. The Democratic Party is democratic in name only. They are a corporate party. They are a capitalist party. They're an imperialist party who want to continue to feed us empty platitudes and then turn around and govern for Wall Street and giant corporations and say that Republicans are bad when the Democrats are doing the exact same thing that Republicans are doing. They just dress up their corruption a lot better. So for me, like, I just feel like the Democrats are so dangerous because they stab us in the back, whereas Republicans stab us in the front. And I just don't think we'll ever see the kind of change we need to combat things like the climate crisis and the economic inequality crisis and the racial injustice crisis if we continue to give these Democrats a free pass. And I think the only hope is to have a direct confrontation with the Democratic Party and for the left to end this abusive relationship they've been stuck in with the Democratic Party. And in order for that to happen, it takes courage. And so I applaud your courage for getting out there and in your district and actually giving people an alternative that is going to fight, and someone who is going to fight for Medicare for all and is going to fight for a Green New Deal and is going to actually fight for the progressive policies that you're campaigning on, and not just feed your district these empty platitudes and then go govern for your corporate donors when you're in office, because you don't have corporate donors, you know, like the person you're running against has. You're funded by the grassroots, which I think, again, people power is all we got. So what do you want people to know about yourself that makes you different from all the other politicians who run for office and then end up being co-opted by this corrupt system?
Well, you know, I'm driven by, as an activist, I'm driven by my values. I'm doing this because I want to see what I consider fairness. I want to see, economic justice, environmental justice. I've been worried about the climate since, for 20 plus years. We've known that the science is what the science is telling us, and we're dragging our feet and dragging our feet and dragging our feet. And, I'm doing this because I feel someone has to. I'm doing this not because I ever aspire to be a politician. I'm doing this because someone has to do it. Someone has to be the candidate who's going to carry this side of the conversation, who's going to make the argument for Medicare for all. Rosa DeLauro is not going to make that argument. She's not going to make the argument that single payer is best. I can do that. I can argue for a Green New Deal. I argue for going further than that and putting a price on carbon, because I think because fossil fuels are so useful. I think to drive down demand, you have to raise the price. But then the revenue from that tax could be a dividend that we divide equally among all people. I call it a universal carbon income. It would be like universal income that everyone gets, and it could be funded by a carbon tax, which would at the same time have the benefit of tilting the economics of how people choose to buy their energy, what form of energy they choose to buy. So,
I just wanted to say one thing, sorry, but because fossil fuels, they're useful for the big oil companies and for the political parties that take money from them, and maybe they're useful in that they're convenient, but the consequences from fossil fuels are not useful to our climate and to working class communities who bear the brunt of the climate crisis, whose neighborhoods and communities are more affected by it. So, you know, I think that's an important distinction to make, because you're right. You know, you said at the beginning, there's great power in the fossil fuel industry. They still have a stranglehold over our government, not just in this country, but the fossil fuel industry owns most of the governments in Europe as well and around the world. But I think that as humans, I think, and you as a scientist yourself, I think, you know, there's one thing, maybe they're convenient and they're useful for the ruling class. But at the end of the day, future generations aren't going to care, how convenient these things were when it's 125 degrees and there's no longer a livable climate and the planet is no longer sustainable because the previous generations were so driven by greed and so scared to stand up to these corrupt corporate interests. They're not going to care how useful fossil fuels maybe were, right? They're going to be like, why didn't they fight a little bit harder? You know, future generations are going to look at us and be like, what were you guys thinking, giving all this power away to these big oil companies and to these political parties that are owned by these big oil companies? Why didn't you fight back harder for the planet, for the people? And I think that that's just an important distinction to make, because, I guess in some ways fossil fuels are cheap. they're readily available. Most cars use them, although we do have more hybrids now. But at the end of the day, I think we have to start looking at the consequences of using them. And as well as, when we talk about our economy and we talk about capitalism in general, there's not enough focus on, it's record profits for corporations and billionaires, but there's also record consequences for our planet and for the overwhelming majority of the people on this planet who are not even earning a living wage. And even in the United States of America, that's quote unquote the richest nation on earth, we have 140 million Americans right now who are either poor or low income. That's almost half our country is either poor or low income. So capitalism isn't working for, you know, almost half of this country. Yet, you know, we have institutions and major corporate media and major corporate parties who it is working for. But that doesn't mean that it's okay, that it's right, and that we should accept it. I think what it means is we have to fight for something better and fight for a world where justice and dignity is available to everyone and not just a handful at the top.
Yeah, I mean, in economics, you know, my philosophy is largely rooted in the old wisdom that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, which is something that I think is kind of lost in a lot of modern discourse about who's rich and who's poor and why they're rich and why they're poor. We tend to want to put all the locus of control on that person to say that, if they're rich, they worked hard. If they're poor, they're not working hard enough. But that just ignores so much of reality, just ignores the reality of how advantage begets advantage. You know, you have, once you have enough money to invest, you know, the money starts doing all the work for you. A speculator can just buy a plot of land if they have enough money and just wait for it to become valuable and then sell it. It becomes possible to make a lot of money without doing work. Meanwhile, the poor are facing the opposite cycle of being trapped in poverty. Their car breaks down. They don't have the $500 to fix it. Now, how are they going to get to work? I thought this was common wisdom that the world, the way the economy works isn't naturally going to, you know, a free economy, quote unquote, free market economy, isn't going to naturally divvy out wealth according to who deserves it. It doesn't work that way. There's this natural phenomenon of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And what are we going to do about it? You know, are we going to let it happen or are we going to intervene? And it's not fair to let it happen. And, you know, there's that myth, if we just leave things alone and cut down regulations and keep taxes low, then, you know, people who work hard will move up and people who don't will stay down and everything will be fair. That's not the natural outcome of a free market economy is not fairness. The natural outcome of a free market economy is inequity and entrenched inequity, entrenched unfairness. Thomas Piketty's book, Capital, talks about this. And I'm hoping that this will be also something that people becomes an increasingly appreciated as common understanding because it's the government is the only entity that's going to come in and address that problem. The government is the only entity that's going to come in and say, okay, look, wealth is accumulating. We're getting in. We need to have a progressive income tax. We need to take wealth, some of this wealth, and redistribute it back to the people who are stuck in the cycle of poverty. And this is just so obvious to me that this is the moral thing to do. But you hear all the time in popular culture that, you know, this is class warfare or, you know, blah, 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 blah. People don't get that this is a role for the government, because if the government doesn't do it, no one's going to do it.
Well, you're hitting on key points. The problem is, though, the government is taking action right now. The government is intervening. But they're not intervening on behalf of the poor and the working class, right? Yeah. The government is intervening by giving massive subsidies and tax breaks and bailouts to the giant corporations and to the billionaire class. And so what you have is you essentially we have two right-wing capitalist parties who are our government right now is what is actually enforcing the class divide. The government is an arm of Wall Street. It is an arm of these giant corporations. So when you say the government needs to intervene to actually, help the economic inequality, I would actually say that, well, they should intervene, but they're doing the opposite. And the capitalist state, the whole point of our government is actually to enrich their corporate donors and to enrich the capitalist class. That is what our government does. And so both of these parties are doing the exact opposite of what needs to be done. And, you know, we saw that in the pandemic with the CARES Act, right? There was a lot of care for the billionaire class and for giant corporations. There was very little to no care for the poor and for the working class. And so that is, in essence, what the problem is the law that is written by our government and by the legislative branch is being, there are these corporations are lobbying both of these parties to write laws that are rigged in their favor and that are rigged against the working class. And so what we need is a government that is doing the exact opposite of what it's doing now. And that is, unfortunately, just the truth of the matter. I mean, you know, the government is... So when I laugh when conservatives say things like, well, you know, the Democrats are a socialist party, or, you know, or they equate socialism with big government, when really socialism is about putting power directly into the hands of the people and into the working class, and actually not having a government that is putting power into the billionaire class and that is continuing to bail out these corporations. So you're right that the government should intervene, but I think it's important to acknowledge that right now we're in the state that we are because of the capitalist state and because of both of these parties continue to serve the interests of the ruling class and work against the interests of everyday people.
Yeah, and you know, one example of the Democrats and the Republicans working together for Wall Street was in the late 90s when they deregulated and repealed the Glass-Steagall reform. And people, some, you know, progressives at the time, Paul Wellstone, I think, you know, said, you know, in 10 years, we're going to regret this. And they just nailed the timeline because it was about 2008 that they repealed Glass-Steagall. And it was about, you know, 2018 that the House of Cards came crashing down because, you know, they just basically, you know, legalized all these gambling structures that are just useful for people to buy and sell things, you know, in a almost really like a betting pool. And it doesn't help anybody. Right. It's just a way of people making money, as turning the stock market into a casino. And the consequences of that, you know, with the financial crash, were just devastating. And, you know, who did we bail out? We bail out the rich corporations. And that was something Democrats and Republicans agreed on, too. You know, oh, gosh, look, they're hurting. These poor corporations are going bankrupt. Not, you know, let's go out and help people afford their rent so that they don't get foreclosed on. You know, not let's help people stay in their homes. You know, we've got to save these poor corporations. So, yeah, it's clear where both the sympathies of both parties really lie when you look at what they do. And you have to not just listen to what they say.
Yeah.
Right?
You have to watch their actions. Yep.
That's a big mistake, because when they talk pretty and they talk nice and they talk values, you know. And, you know, Barack Obama made that breakout speech at the Democratic convention. And I said, wow, this guy's fantastic, you know, and because he's so charming. And he said, you know, I care about not just my grandma. I care about everybody's grandma. You know, I care about everybody because they're an American. And I want to, you know, I'm not just here for myself. But we got to bond together as Americans and take care of each other. You know, he was expressing real progressive liberal values, and they do that. You know, they're good at that. But you really have to watch what they're doing very yep. carefully.
Yep. They talk like leftists and then they govern like corporatists, and they do it over and over again. And you see it now. That's why I'm so weary of people like the Pete Buttigieg and even Kamala Harris, who kind of adopt Obama's rhetoric. And talking like a progressive. But again, words and phrases don't mean anything if they're just going to turn around and govern for Wall Street and their corporate donors, which is, in essence, what they accuse the Republicans of. They're doing the very same thing. Look, this has been a great conversation. We're nearing the end here. What would you like to say, Justin, to anyone who's listening about kind of party, kind of final thoughts? Why should they kind of get involved in helping your campaign? And how can they get involved if they would like to in helping your grassroots campaign for Congress?
Thanks. Yeah, I want to encourage people to, like I said, consider running for office themselves, supporting third-party independent left candidates, and not just, and you know, really understand that the duopoly is not all we have to live with. We don't have to live like this. We can do better. I really want people to understand that, you know, especially with ranked choice voting, it's going to be a game changer. And a better world is possible. We don't have to vote out of fear. We don't have to accept duopoly. We don't have to just try to reform one of the two choices. We don't just have to vote lesser evil. You know, third party is where my hope is for the future. And whether it's the Green Party or any other independent, but it has to be a real party with candidates on the ballot. So go out and support those people. And if you want to support me, my website is justinforall.org. And you can sign up for the newsletter. You can donate. I appreciate people's support. You know, we will use that money carefully to try and spread the word, the values that I've been talking about. And yeah, I appreciate, let me thank you again for having me on.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you for listening to another episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight. And before we go, I want to take this moment to thank our benefactors who contribute $20 a month to the show to keep this show alive and going. So I want to thank Kenny Ballantyne, Tyler Sambucci, Nate Tecito, Lloyd Chapman, Ed Romo, John Lippman, John Paul DeLuca, Susan Sarandon, DJ Comatose, Patty Cleary, and Elizabeth Kim. Thank you so much for your generous donations. And thank you, everyone, for supporting the podcast and supporting my work. I really appreciate it. Again, go to patreon.com/ampedup if you want to support the podcast as well. And for as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to our bonus content. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll catch you next week with an all-new episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight.